We ready?
Hello.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. We have a few people have signed up to testify on 2009, but at least one comes from Corvallis and has a 4 o'clock meeting in Corvallis. So I think what I'll do is open up a hearing on 2009. Mike, is there anybody else from Corvallis with you that wants to testify? Anybody else from out of town? Okay, why don't we... All right, why don't we open it up? Forest Grove? Okay, but you don't have a meeting at 4 o'clock somewhere? Okay. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll open up the public hearing on 2009. We'll have a... we'll call you up for that, and then we'll close the hearing and come back to a public hearing on... 2245. Spend a little time on that one, and then we'll come back open to a public hearing on 2009. We do need to be out of here precisely by 5 o'clock or even a few minutes before if we can, because I have two other meetings when we're done with this one. So I'll open a public hearing on 2009. I'll call Dr. Huntington up to start. And are you bringing somebody with you?
Yes.
Okay.
Jan Thornton.
I do want to say that we are about ready to submit a list of amendments, proposals to the Legislative Council. It will include a whole different section on the exchange, on Section 18, and a variety of other things that Representative Maurer and I have worked on. And it may change a lot of things that you want to testify on. So... let us know what's on your mind, but things will be changing a bit.
Mr. Chair, are you going to send us any information about the nature of those?
I am. As soon as we get it in the form, that will go to the LC, which I hope will be maybe tomorrow or at the latest Wednesday, we'll distribute that. We'll distribute that to the committee.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yep.
And Chairman Greenlich, thank you for coming to Corvallis last week to hear our citizens' comments on health care reform. And members of the health care committee, I am Mike Huntington of Corvallis, co-convener of the Oregon Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. I speak today in favor of HB 2009 and a strong Oregon health authority. There will be 6 slides that I will be showing as we go. Most of the testimony that I've heard objecting to the concept of the Oregon Health Authority has come from insurance and hospital industry representatives. I would like to present respectful opposition to some of their testimony and also acknowledge the pragmatic resistance to change that may be within many of us. I respond to Mr. Fiskum and Mr. Becker's proposals that, number one, the private health insurance market is viable and vital to the success of our health care system, that high insurance premiums and out-of-pocket costs reflect primarily medical costs rather than administrative costs of insurance, that a healthy private insurance market must be protected so there is some place to shift costs to, and finally, that the market can somehow save us. Please take a look at the chart that you see there and the ones on your handout and decide how viable and reliable private health insurance is as a vehicle for getting good health care to all Oregonians. These charts come from a book written by John Guyman, MD of Seattle, and the book is called Do Not Resuscitate. On this first slide, you can see how workers' earnings were flat between 2000 and 2006, while insurance premiums increased 87%. In figure 1.4, you can see how household incomes will be meeting insurance, just insurance premium payments alone by 2025. Now, long before that, private health insurance as a primary option will have disappeared. How much farther can this vehicle go? Mr. Becker of Regents Blue Cross Shield 2 weeks ago said essentially, it's not the insurance industry, it's the medical costs. I think it's both. Providers can, in my experience, increase charges almost at will. And there's an unbounded appetite for high-cost, high-tech, the latest drug or treatment. But high medical costs are also related to the fragmentation of our system, and we have not given ourselves the authority to defragment the system. Our hard drive is about to shut down. Within our borders, insurance companies are doing things that may be logical from a business perspective, but are very costly to society and antithetical to the original concept of insurance. That is, spread the fate and the risk of being alive as broadly as possible. And now at this table, just get a little hint of what Blue Cross of California has used to deny insurance, both at the initial application and by mining people's medical records and almost bribing physicians or coercing them to be their investigators to find out if a patient has not included a certain amount of medical information. Blue Cross of California has faced a number of high-profile lawsuits because of this. And there's another industry that's spawned by this. It's called the denial industry. One denial consultant is Athena Health. It increased its revenues from $1 million to $86 million in a matter of 6 years in its bid just to help the physicians get the insurers to pay payments. Of course, the insurers had their equally high-priced consultants to show them how to avoid paying those providers. Now, what happens as a result of all this superfluous Super Bowl football game? Well, you can see what happens to administrative costs. This chart shows the growth of physicians over a period of 30 years compared to the growth of administrators, and this includes insurance workers. Finally, with the costs... Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brief question. Growth as measured by...
Numbers of workers. Right.
Thank you.
And finally, with the cost of premiums unaffordable to employers and individuals, insurance companies offer consumer-driven plans that are high deductible and low cost. You can see what happens as a result of this type of popular plan, at least popular to insurance companies. Look at the results. For a less than $500 deductible, well, basically you can see what happens. For a high deductible plan, you may not be able to get your prescriptions filled, your test or treatment done, see your primary care or your specialist, and we end up with worse care and worse outcomes. If there's no one in charge, especially someone representing the public, how can we expect that the public interest will be served? It's a free-for-all, and at least a third of us are getting trampled. How can we get this mess under control? One of the speakers from the insurance industry said here last week that the concept of the Oregon Health Authority is looking less like collaboration and more like regulation. I hardly agree. Chairman Greenlink and members of the committee, as you deliberate on House Bill 2009, please build into it a strong public voice as outlined in sections 1 through 27 so that Oregon can achieve the oversight and regulation of its health care efforts that we so desperately need. This bill contains the software that will save our hard drive and our healthcare system. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If I could, I'd just like to make a comment. You know, I was looking at your denial management, and I guess I was thinking of an experience I had 2 years ago when I had knee surgery, pre-authorized by my provider or by my insurance provider. 14 phone calls later, and I'm not sure, around 11 months, it was fully paid for. You know, that's part of the reason your next graph is so germane, is because the administration is there. And I just finished in November. I had a new crown put on, pre-authorized again, and on our, I think we got lucky this time. I think it was our third or fourth phone call. The pre-authorized crown was paid for by the dental program. And I just...
don't understand the resources that are being wasted on okaying things and then denying payment. And as I talked to a relative who's involved in the dental profession, says it's virtually standard. And I don't know about the accuracy of that, but I
my
think
wife used
I've
to say
experienced it.
When she was managing a chiropractic office, that she assumed any claim they submitted would be rejected and then they would have to resubmit. But it isn't always in the insurance industry. Sometimes it's I remember when I was a corporate officer of Kaiser Permanente, I was admitted to the hospital by Kaiser in Washington, D.C., and the bill never got paid, and I kept getting dunning bills, and they were about to send me to the collection agency, and I finally called the CEO of the Washington branch of Kaiser. He said, well, I'll see if I can find out what happens, and it came back, and he said, well, we didn't pay it because we never could verify that you were actually a member of the program. Well, you know, if you can't find a corporate officer in your membership.
Well, Chairman Greenlink and Representative Kenmer, I'd like to have the committee also remember a figure, 30%. In Oregon, 30% of new applications for health care insurance are denied. And 30% of all...
That's individual.
Individual. And 30% of all claims are denied on the first go-around.
Yes, Representative Thompson.
You know, what you were saying, Mr. Chair, and Representative, the other end the same way, one of the things I think we have to keep in the front of this process is we need to make sure this process is seamless from the patient through the return check, however this comes about. I had a similar situation several years ago with an employee who was covered by company insurance, and we're going back and forth between the doctor and the insurance company. You'd call the doctor's office, and they said the insurance company didn't pay for it. Call the insurance company, they said, well, the doctor didn't file the right forms. You call the doctor back, the doctor files the right form. Insurance company said, well, they didn't get the right form. And finally, I said, okay, enough is enough. You know, everybody's going to fax everything to everybody by 1 o'clock today, or I'm going to call the corporate attorney. Man, just like that, it all got cleared up. It was the insurance company's fault, but they were playing footsie with, you know, you didn't fill out line 17A on the form, therefore we're going to deny the whole claim. And it was just ridiculous. In the amount of money we spent on that one claim far surpassed the value of the claim, just trying to get two entities to talk to one another.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
Okay. Mr. Chair, may I?
I know it was you, and then you got me then.
Yeah, you're trying.
See, that's how you do it.
Trying to run over. No, you never run. Dr. Huntington,
yes.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
And we've had several conversations, and I wonder, what do you think Medicare's role has in the increasing cost of health care?
Very high. It's obviously the elephant in the room. It affects what everyone else charges.
But probably not those health insurance premiums that you had on that chart, right? That's, I suspect, not Medicare.
No, these aren't.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think anybody's going to question those. Your statistic, although in your very last chart where you're deductible, because I'm a state employee, I have no deductible or I pay nothing toward my health insurance premium. But, in the private world, I'd be yay, I had a $500 deductible. I'd be happy with that today. And as time goes on, because that's from 2003. Right?
Instead of $2,500.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
That's
right. I am just not convinced that we're on a teeter totter and primarily, or, I mean, we're a teeter totter today. Half of it's private money and half of it's government funded money, Medicare, Medicaid, and to shift that to essentially government money, I don't believe it's going to get us to where we really want to be. Because my experience with Medicare in their administration, yeah, they have 4% or 2% administration, but boy, they're really good at dumping it on me, you know, back in the private provider world. And so I guess I'm just not convinced that we're kind of leaning in the right direction. The problem is we know that the carriage is on the side of the road and it's broken apart. We got to put it back together. But I think we may disagree which side the wheels go on.
But 2009, actually, I mean, as I see it, as I envision it, is about managed competition among private, or is sort of controlling how things work. I mean, if we create an insurance exchange, we'll certainly have private entities in it. In fact, that piece is getting some criticism from. Now, it might all, it will also have a public entity to compete, but it does not turn into something like the terrible system you grew up in, the military system, where it's all salaried physicians and government run.
Well, and my only comment to that is, had it not been for the civilian market to back up the military, it would have been a disaster. I mean, it had a very different role, and you can't.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Chairman,
if
I may gripe one more time, I have one more gripe.
Okay. Gripe one more time. And then
it's very interesting to me. One of the reasons I wanted to serve on this committee is this issue of bureaucracy and the ethical implications. As a psychologist, one of the reasons I no longer practice is that I was spending about 15 to 20 minutes per hour of therapy writing reports, supervising billing, redoing things, and frankly compromising my patients' personal information, because I found that as these companies got it, they didn't always honor where the records were kept or the confidentiality, and when they got sold, all kinds of interesting and horrible things happened. And I think it's quite an atrocity that we need to be thinking about, and the enormous amount of expense that's put into all of those denials, and the fact that all that paper and all of those records are handled, and with the electronic age, handled, if we're not careful, maliciously.
We're going to have a bill on that one that will help that one. But also,
thank you.
Also, I think the answer is we should do away with fee-for-service payment. That's the big problem. We got to find a way to move capitation payment out so that providers can spend their time providing instead of writing reports.
Yep.
Go for it.
Thanks for seeing me. My name is Jan Thornton.
Right in it.
My family lives in Corvallis, and we are a typical American middle-income family. Both my husband and I work in order to have a good living. It's a modest income. We have two children, one in college at OSU, one in high school. Today I'd like to call your attention to an issue that I haven't heard very much about. I've heard about the children not having insurance in a country. I've heard about low-income health care. I haven't heard very much about the discrimination that's going on against those of us that are trying to receive individual medical insurance policies. When you go to work for a large company, and so many people in this country have, you're not concerned about your medical insurance. You sign on the dotted line. They don't ask you much about your health in the past, and you got insurance. That's it. Recently, my husband was laid off from a large company. We decided once he was laid off, we looked at COBRA. I'm sorry, but COBRA would cost us $1,400 every month just for the premiums. That doesn't include the copays. That doesn't include all the things that they don't cover. So once we looked at COBRA, then we thought, well, we'll go to the insurance companies. We'll apply. We've never had any issues before in getting insurance. We're a healthy family. There's nothing wrong with us, basically. Well, we found out differently from the insurance companies. We were denied, by six insurance companies. They said the reason was, and I quote, "We had the potential for future medical expenses." Doesn't everybody? Nobody is without that possibility. They declined us, and they said, oh, you've got to go to the high insurance pool, or the high risk pool, because our son has asthma, my husband has high blood pressure. Now, honestly, I looked it up, and according to the CDC, 9.4% of the kids in our country now have asthma. 31% of all adults over the age of 20 have high blood pressure. So for the insurance companies to tell us to go to the high-risk pool, are they really in the high-risk pool going to be able to cover 31% of all adults, 9.4% of all kids through the high-risk pool? So once we couldn't get insurance from them because we checked, the cost on that was $1,300 per month. We can't afford $1,300 per month. That's just not feasible with a modest middle American income family. So I ask you, what do you do? What's a family to do when the insurance companies all reject you? You're on your own. My husband started his own business. We have no other options. We can't get in the high-risk pool because we make not enough money. I ask you to please look at the discrimination. Stop the insurance companies from being allowed to do this. They need to have some type of regulations saying that they can't deny people just because they've got some little thing wrong. Yes, asthma is a big thing, but, you know, that whole list that Mike put up there a few minutes ago, that's not right. It shouldn't be that way.
Do I take it you're testifying in favor of the section on the insurance exchange that would require guaranteed issue and community rating?
Yes. The problem is the insurance companies basically can run our lives. They can tell us whether we can have insurance or not. So basically, if you're trying for individual insurance, you have to work for a company that you don't want to work for necessarily in order to get insurance. Because as an individual, our own little company, we couldn't get insurance. So that forces you to work where you don't want to work. You have to pay the premiums that they set, which are above your limits. You have to then accept the fact that they're going to decline you on a lot of your benefits because you can't do x-rays, you have to pay those out of your pocket. They say what you can and can't have covered. They are ruling our country, at least most of our private lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think a point to draw from this in addition to the exchange is that when you applied for COBRA and they told you how much it would cost, mm-hmm. that's what your employer was paying on your behalf when you were working in that job, and a large proportion of that was the cost shift from the uninsured to the insured. So a big piece of that premium for that group coverage, and that's what COBRA does, it gives you the chance to buy individually the group coverage that your employer was paying. That is what your employer is paying on your behalf, and it's making it harder and harder for employers to continue to provide that kind of coverage for their employees. And
Mr. Chair, thank you. So if we have community rating guaranteeing coverage.
And a large enough pool.
Wow.
Yeah. And a million people in a pool.
Okay.
That's the key.
The prices, that price for the policy is going to come down, but it's not going to come down that much. It's not going to go from $1,400 a month down to $600 a month. It does spread the risk, but
cost. We have to do something on the cost side in order to make that sustainable.
Well,
there's no question about that.
And then, so the question is, I'm kind of taking off on you, is how do we deal with that control? Because then you have to have either a prior authorization system or just tell people, no, we don't cover that. And I think those are really difficult questions. So at some point, we have to say no.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. Dr. Huntington's chart that talked about consumer choice health plans came about in response to managed care. So people said, we don't really want to have restrictions on the way we receive care. So their insurance company said, okay, we'll jack up the premium, we'll give you all the choice you want, but then it's going to be consumer choice, you pay for it. So you're right. Somewhere we need to get to the point where consumers have the ability to understand this relationship between either you organize things in some rational way and reduce the cost, or you pay the price. And I would assume in a market system we can have both kinds of models available for people.
I'm not going to disagree.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me that would make sense. Thank you both very much.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
I have in the sign-up sheet that there are two people that have come from more than 100 miles. Is that right? John Elliott, is that? Did you check the right box here?
Yes.
Come on up now. And Kathy Carpenter, is it?
Ralph
also Wyatt. More than 100 miles?
Ralph Wyatt.
Almost 100 miles?
No, of course, that's
okay.
twerking. Ralph and I are part of a panel.
Come on. Mr. Wyatt as well?
Yes.
Okay, great.
That's correct.
We're going along pretty well. If we keep going along pretty well, we'll finish this segment and then move to the next one. Please introduce yourself.
John Elliott, Chair of the Klamath County Board of Commissioners. I'm also a past chairman of the City County Insurance Services Board of Trustees, and I am also a member of the Board of Directors of the Association of Oregon Counties, and in that capacity I am appearing here today.
Thank you for coming this far. It's not in response to my bill to abolish counties that you'll be here.
We like the number.
I would probably reverse the process. Yeah. Put more power in the hands of the counties.
And I'm Ralph Wyatt. I'm also a trustee with City County Insurance Services, also on the AOC Board of Directors and the Linn County Administrative Officer.
Thank you.
First, I would like to express that the Association of Oregon County applauds the efforts of Chair Greenlich and the work of the Oregon Health Fund Board for putting together a plan to address the healthcare cost dilemma. We understand there are many stakeholders and moving parts, and this is a monumental task. The Association has not taken an official position on HB 2009 in its entirety, and I understand parts of it are still being or awaiting the publisher's ink.
Daily.
And we have supported certain aspects of the bill in past sessions, like expanding health care for children. We are still looking at the bill for its intended and, perhaps more importantly, its unintended consequences. Counties are well aware of the problems with escalating health care costs, and we want to be, and I would dare say we need to be, part of that solution. Klamath County employs some 650 employees in various capacities. We wrestle with this on a daily basis. And we are looking forward to working with the committee on this bill. However, in its early version, there is a red flag for us, and specifically that is Section 10, Subsection 2A, which states the board is authorized to, quote, undertake joint contracting for health care services on behalf of the public entities participating in the Public Health Employer Coalition, unquote. The Public Health Employer Coalition would include the leadership of cities and counties, along with others. We have three major concerns with this language and at least two additional unresolved issues. Local benefits packages are currently developed using a total compensation approach. That is, it's not just the salary, but it is the salary and all the associated benefits that determine what that position costs. The potential cost increases, and while the goal here is a long-term savings, we fear that in the short term, and that short term is a relative thing. Short can be 5 or 6 years or more, but it has the potential to drive the costs up. Also, several categories of employees are subject to binding arbitration to resolve contractual disputes. Counties would no longer be able to individually change plans to resolve local issues, but may be potentially required to provide benefits or other compensation. And there is a lack of process. This bill does not require the authority board to give counties sufficient notice to make changes. Several counties have personnel contracts that extend several years, and a violation of those contracts could result and leave open counties to lawsuits and contractual or bargaining unit grievances.
So. Well, Chair Greenlich, again, and committee members, thank you very much. As was mentioned, this is a huge issue. It's got huge costs, and from our perspective, and admittedly it's a little bit a narrow perspective, it's got a lot of ramifications. John mentioned contracts. For example, Linn County has four union contracts. They're four-year contracts. Some of them involve binding arbitration. And I can tell you from doing union negotiations on all four of those, one of the biggest parts of the puzzle for employees, and again, this is focused on public employees, is health care, what kind of benefits are there, how they get them. Three of our contracts have a specific total compensation formula so that it's salary, benefits, including PERS, and all of that goes into a formula that develops and produces a COLA that we do every year. So there's some ramifications on the labor relations bargaining side that ORSs that literally drive us, and I think you're probably familiar with that. And especially for strike prohibited units, there's some complications there that I think need to be factored into this whole process, and that's really what we're asking. Because there's an issue on whether you have options or not in your exchange, insurance exchange, and what the timing of all of that is. Because if there's some back and forth, some feedback in this process, and we can talk about how the different pieces of the ORSs would interplay, it would certainly be helpful. And that's really what we're asking for, is a place at the table to talk about those things. Again, the whole health cost process is huge, and if in fact you can lower that, that would be very helpful. The other piece to the puzzle is, as we mentioned, we're trustees on city county insurance services. We provide health insurance for a good portion of the cities and some of the counties in the state. Over 9,000 employees, over 21,000 insured lives. So there's a process there, and there's a lot of services there that I think we would like some consideration for as we move through this process. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you both very much. At least in this point, I think it is not our intention to have in this bill or this session the details of how an exchange might work. I think it's our intention to create the authority, to create the board, to put in place that there shall be an exchange, have a few principles in it, and then leave it to the authority board to design a plan that we'll get back in the 2011 session. So it's not our intention to deal with any of the kinds of things that you're talking with, but maybe put some goals into it and ask to get a plan back by December of 2010 that we can look at.
That would be great, because, for example, with public employees, after they retire by another ORS, they can remain members. Like, it's sort of a COBRA. You pay your own premium, but you stay part of the plan, which affects the experience, of course, of that plan. And the pharmacy is part and parcel of it.
You raise very cogent issues that clearly have to be taken into account when the actual implementation of this thing is designed.
And I'm quite sure
you'll have a place at the table.
Very good. I think that's the main thing that we're looking at is to be part of that process.
Thank you both for coming.
Mr. Chair, options are great.
Oh, sure. Please. Yes.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask a question about the total compensation piece. So although even when this is all rolled out and, you know, the exchange is in place and, you know, let's say all the pieces are where we want them to be, and you at the county level were bargaining total compensation,
right?
You still have leverage on the salary side, right, to do whatever you need to do on salary to get to where you need to be competitive in terms of total compensation.
Well,
I'm not sure what exactly has changed there.
Okay, the way the process is written into the contract, essentially you take all the employees in the bargaining unit, you total their salaries, you total the cost of their benefits, you total their payroll costs. In other words, all the costs to have, say, 150 employees in that bargaining unit. It goes up, you negotiate, it's tied to the Portland CPIW in our case. You on a calendar year basis. Again, you negotiate all of this. You add in these contract provisions 1% to that total dollar amount, and then you spend it. Basically, if you want something, if you want a longevity step built in to your structure, you cost that out. If you want to improve your benefit package, you cost that out. If PERS gives you a 4% increase, you cost that out. And you hope, generally speaking, with the COLA, that you come out above zero. A couple of times we have come out very, very close to zero because of PERS increases. But essentially, what you do is you give the employees a stake in exactly what they have, and they can choose. We reopen every year, and their choice has been, we want health insurance, very, very good benefits, and that's what they spend their money on. It's their money.
And you would continue to be able to do that.
How does that change, is the question?
Well, the question I have is, do you have options? Do you have benefit? I mean, you're still working this out.
Well, options the health fund good. Board suggests that there be a minimum benefit package, and then that you be able to add on depending
okay.
on
it
what
may
you
not
want
be.
To purchase. I mean, that's...
But one of the,
what they're talking about.
Yeah, one of the problems that City County Insurance Services had with Lincoln County is they were providing the insurance benefit package, and literally CIS stopped providing that plan. It went to binding arbitration, and literally the county had to continue to provide the plan, plus they had to buy in addition because it wasn't a comparable benefit to what they had had in the contract before. So part of it is just the way the process works, and I know this is not a general public problem, but...
Well, it is. I mean, yeah. For example, in the Portland Public Schools, they negotiate in a very similar way, but they start with the notion that they have a Blue Cross Blue Shield price next year and a Kaiser price next year and an estimate of the self-insured price next year. And they're negotiating how much of that are going to be paid by the teachers versus
right.
how much by the Health and Welfare Trust. I mean, it's the way the world is now.
Chair Green, look to Representative Dumbrough. I think part of that question, it's evolving in more and more counties. The caps that have been put on counties on property tax increases, for example, that were limited by statute now to 3%, no more. More and more fees are being... collected through the counties, passed along to the state. More and more responsibilities are being placed on the counties. All that said, it combines a level that if we are limited to 3%, in most counties, those property taxes are they're significant, but they're not the significant impact of their budgets. With other declining revenues, we're caught in a hammer between 15% and 20% increases in medical insurance benefits, a CPI demand for real wage adjustments, and then, by the way, please increase our cap on our medical insurance contributions. So all of these demands is forcing more and more counties to look at this total compensation package. So we're going to ask the employees, okay, if we're going to grant a 3% increase in costs, where do you want that? And probably as Ralph has indicated, over the last several years, they've opted for increased medical benefits.
The same.
It I would urge you more. To get full just square behind what we're trying to do.
Right.
Because this is the only way we're going to ever put a lid on the kind of increases you're facing over time, is if we can combine the purchasing power of the state in a way where we can have an effect on the market rather than have the market have an effect on us. Right now, you have no choice in terms of what you're facing, in terms of increase in health care.
There is that. Yes, sir.
You're a victim in that case. Well, thank you both very much
thank
for
you.
Coming. I very appreciate
well.
You driving all the
Mr.
way up.
Mr. Chair, I'd say the employees are the victims because when you use the total compensation
absolutely.
Approach, it's ultimately they're the ones making the decision.
Right.
And on how that is distributed, and as healthcare becomes a larger piece of the pie, it is. You are going to go negative.
you're going to have, you are going to approach a period of time where you go negative in your wage increases.
Well, the experience we've had is employees are much more aware of the cost of health insurance than they, I would say, in most organizations, and they're careful and they pay attention to things because they know that it has a direct impact on salary.
That's what I said.
So it does, this sort of approach does have broader pieces to it. Unfortunately, most organizations in the state don't use it.
I'm going to say thank you one more time in right. hopes of actually getting rid of you.
And no offense taken.
Thank you very much. We have two more folks. We might as well finish up this panel. Kathy Kapanen, is it? And Jenna Arends, is that correct? Nobody's responding. Am I botching it? Oh, here we go. Okay, good. I didn't botch it.
Close.
Thank you. We're going to continue to have lots of time to testify in 2009 as we move along, and eventually we'll have some specific proposals to get testimony on.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick and committee members. My name is Kathy Carpenter, and I'm from Forest Grove. And I thank you for allowing me to speak today. As you all know, many jobs are being lost, not only in Oregon, but in the country as a whole. And I have concerns about tying health care coverage to employers for this reason. As people lose their jobs with health care benefits, they can't afford to pay the COBRA premiums. I had experience with this myself when my husband lost his job in 2004. We had a COBRA premium of $746 a month, which we couldn't afford, so we went out without insurance for over a year. I'm disabled, and both my husband, Mike, and I are diabetic. We spent that time without doctor's visits, without health care coverage. We stopped taking prescriptions when they ran out. Eventually, when I needed to restart some of my medicines, I couldn't afford the $130 office visit to see the doctor so that they could write me new prescriptions. I now have Social Security disability, and I'm covered under Medicare, but my husband is not. He doesn't feel secure because there's possibility that he could lose the job that he now has. For that reason, they're decreasing the hours on the job. If he is able to keep his job, we fear that his benefits will be cut in order to keep him working. For that reason, he would be without insurance, and he wouldn't, on his own, be eligible for 7 more years when he's old enough to get Medicare. He's only 58 now. I fear for his health if he loses his job. I strongly support the measure in HB 2009 that calls for sliding scale premium assistance for Oregonians up to 300% of FPL. People can't continue to sustain the loss of health care along with salaries. They need to be healthy enough to work and support their families. I encourage all of you to act quickly to meet the current need of the ever-expanding numbers of uninsured Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee members. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. Our members provide about $180 million worth of services to children and families throughout Oregon, touching the lives of over 95,000 children each year. And these communities include Prineville, Portland, and Pendleton to, let's say, Grants Pass. The submitted documents in front of you have a list of our member agencies and their locations. I'm sure you'll see many constituents represented there. You also have a little bit of information on more detail of who we are as an organization. But what I want to speak to is just briefly the comments that are reflected on that top page. These programs deliver evidence-based services with very good outcomes. We keep kids out of prison and out of emergency rooms, which is a long-term benefit and savings and part of the safety net for Oregon's economic future, and that's the requirement of Senate Bill 267 and evidence-based practices. So we're very pleased to have had such significant outcomes for those programs. We're very supportive of this committee's effort to try and reorganize the healthcare system in Oregon. There are many challenges for you, and I am impressed with how I've seen you, even just in the hearing today, and trying to make those amendments and address those issues. And I hope to be able to have an opportunity to work with you in the future on this endeavor. In the meantime, we would like to ask for a small tweak, one sentence out of 268 pages, so we're very pleased to offer this brief amendment, and ask that the children who are represented currently in the Oregon Health Plan who receive mental health and addiction services be included in your consideration for provider reimbursement rates, as well as hospitals which aren't named. Just to give you just a couple of quick little bullets on why this is important.
It's we, a piece of that $100 million we have sitting there.
Yes, that's correct. That's my understanding in the bill and my discussions with you, Chair. The we partnered with managed health organizations and with the Department of Human Services to conduct a cost study to take a look at the kids' mental health system. Currently, reimbursement rates for providers is only at 60% of costs. We also took a snapshot of the, and I shouldn't use the term fiscal well-being because well-being is not what we learned from the snapshot, but the fiscal situation for these agencies. They have lost 39% of their net assets in the last 4 years. We're very challenged to be able to continue to maintain the current status of the systems and the outcomes that we've been receiving with our reimbursement system now. And we'd really like to see those an addition of kids to the Oregon Health Plan, but we're also challenged to be able to make a commitment to be present to deliver those services.
Are there questions? Yeah, I mean, we all feel that we need to find a way to increase that reimbursement so we can get providers that are both willing and able to be a part of the plan. And that's, I think, very much on our agendas.
They will be here. They are going to collapse.
Yep, absolutely.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask you how much your providers spend on charting to get reimbursement?
On charting, I heard, Chair Green, like a representative, I heard your comments earlier, and I had to nudge the gentlemen who are here with me today to tell him how much that sounded like my conversations with our members. We spend a significant amount of therapist time trying to document for Medicaid and to pass as all of the oversight expectations that the state and federal government have for us, and it's discouraging. It's one of the challenges we have in retaining competent staff.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, you know, it's kind of interesting, and I'll try not to editorialize too long.
Go ahead.
But, you know, part of the thing is you have to do this to protect yourself from regulatory as well as the insurance. And then you're spending all of this time, and it jeopardizes particularly young therapists, frankly, because they put things in there that they shouldn't. And then finally, you know, I was after the election, I was invited by the Perry Center to visit. They estimate 42% of therapist hours are spent on regulatory functions. 42%. That's dang near half. I mean, you know, and these are pretty needy kids. And it's just, there's something wrong with that system.
We really need to make sure that we've done the things that we need to do to get these kind of cost containment things in, and we need to make sure that we're not creating a regulatory nightmare that makes it worse rather than better. That's really
we can, Mr. Chair, we can author a Measure 50 for healthcare administration. We could cap how much time could be spent on administration.
Yeah, grow the rate of inflation 3%.
That would solve the problem.
Can I withdraw my comment?
What we need to do is to make sure we develop the kind of systems that, both in terms of reimbursement systems and regulatory systems, where that doesn't happen. That
they need to work together.
We can do that. We can be better. This is the 21st century. It isn't all that complicated. Of course, you need to make sure everybody has an electronic medical record first. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Just a comment. We heard an allusion in some earlier testimony to someone who stayed with an employer in order not to expose themselves to the cost of COBRA or the possibility that they would be denying coverage in an individual plan. And I heard a story recently about an even more sort of perverse consequence of this system, which was a woman in an abusive relationship who was quite sick and receiving coverage through her husband, the abuser's work. And her fear of getting out of this relationship, ending this marriage, because of her concern that it would mean losing the insurance that she had and the care that she had for her cancer. And it just was so horrifying. And I hope we take up this insurance exchange with real vigor, because we can't continue.
She also needed a referral to a good divorce lawyer. And that's a serious statement. I mean, that responsibility can't be given up. But it's just we just hear one heartbreaking story after another about the insurance world, the way it operates now, and the perversity of it. I don't think we're going to sweep this. This bill doesn't provide immediate revolutionary change in the healthcare system, and none of us are trying to do that. But what we hope is it'll provide a first step and a structure within which that can take place, and a roadmap for how we move over the next decade to get. But you're right; those stories are oppressive.
Mr. Chair,
I'm going to close the hearing. No, go ahead.
Just one more comment, I guess, as someone who's been a practitioner over time, and I guess I remember back in the 70s when basically authorizations were pretty automatic with very minimal amounts of information, and that generated HMOs because of health maintenance organizations because of overutilization. And, you know, the pendulum has now swung to overregulation. And I think the job we have is to try and figure out how we steer this back in a more reasonable, balanced way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2245 and ask Madam Administrator to give us a brief overview, but we'll ask the first witness to work our way through it.
Call up the board.
Yeah, but will you start, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 2245. Comes to you through the governor's office at the request of the Board of Radiologic Technology. They're asking for several things in this bill. One, they're asking for a name change from the Board of Radiologic Technology to the Board of Medical Imaging. They're defining medical imaging modality and other related terms, which is an expansion to include some new modalities. It creates specific modalities of the new medical imaging field that's transpiring. It revises specific provisions relating to the licensing of licensees and limited X-ray machine operator permits. And it does some other things that the board will tell us about, Mr. Chair.
Well, let's start with Linda Russell from the board. And is that Randy Harp? And also, well, let's start with Linda and Thomas King first, the two board people, and then we have three others. I think we have
you need over to there, go that over way, there. Not in front of the dais. Uh-huh.
Yes. What's
the board wanted to speak to you today. I was just bringing the testimony up.
Board? Well, that's who I think I've called, right?
Oh, okay. Yes.
The board members.
He's actually the chair of the legislature.
Okay. How many board members do you have?
I have.
There's four of us. I can defer to Dr. Erickson if you like.
Well, why don't you decide the order you want?
Why don't you go first?
Well,
something what I'd like to have happen first is somebody work through the bill so we know what's in it. Is that... Okay, well then let's start with working our way through the bill.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee members. I'm Dr. Frank Erickson, an MD from Pendleton, Oregon. I'm the radiologist member of the OBRT and the vice chair. I'm also the chair of the Legal Legislative Committee. House Bill 2245 is the proposed language collaboratively developed for the Oregon Board of Radiologic Technologies Legislative Concept, LC 736, and being introduced for your consideration today. HB 2245 will further the board's mission of public protection and will align the board with those medical imaging technologies commonly recognized as standards of care for all patients in Oregon and across the nation. The purpose of the bill is to modernize regulatory authority and terminology by adding three currently unlicensed existing modalities, namely MRI, nuclear medicine, and diagnostic medical sonography. To add regulation also of emerging technologies such as hybrid imaging equipment like PET CT, combination technology machines, and to modernize the name of the board, changing it to the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging. The name change reflects currently used terminology and emerging modalities. Another purpose is to make a name change for the limited permit holders, as they're now known, to Limited X-ray Machine Operator, or LXMO. This name change will keep Oregon's terminology modern and in accord with state and national professional societies. In background, the field of radiology has undergone many technological advancements since the board's creation in 1977. Radiology has become known as medical imaging, and this reflects new technologies that are widely available and commonly performed in Oregon. Diagnostic medical sonography, nuclear medicine, and magnetic resonance imaging do not currently fall within the scope of the original board and are not regulated in Oregon. Nationally, Oregon would be the first state to license diagnostic medical sonography with HB 2245. In response to a request from legislators, the board has collaborated with stakeholders and interested parties in legislative update meetings, resulting in 12 draft language changes to ORS 688.405 through 605 and 688.915 in the effort to produce HB 2245.
Dr. Erickson, if I can interrupt at
this yes, sir.
Point, in terms of your comment, I must say the board was before us last time. We had some problems with things. We worked with the board to ask them to deal with things, and I just would like to commend you all on the fact that you all really did everything you could to do what it is we said needed to happen, and
I
really admired that and appreciated it.
It was not without cost.
But it might also be with profit.
We are very hopeful for that, yes sir. Thank you for noticing. Upon approval of its 2009 legislative concept in this bill, the new mission statement of the board will be: the mission of the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging is to promote, preserve, and protect the public health, safety, and welfare of Oregonians while undergoing medical imaging studies performed by agency licensees for the purpose of medical diagnosis and therapy. And I wanted to say here that there are other comments still coming in addition to the packet that's been presented to you from other interested parties, one of which was very eloquent, that cannot be presented yet because it hasn't been approved by their administrators. But they mentioned that they wanted to let you know that from the viewpoint of patients, they're in a fragile condition in the hands of medical imaging practitioners, and he thought that should be a point made to you, that this is why this is a very important bill, and that someone going in as a patient should not be worried about who is practicing upon them as part of the experience of having to go in to be imaged. The board believes very strongly in public safety and its responsibility to provide oversight, establish high standards of practice, educational requirements, and eligibility guidelines through licensure. Licensure acknowledges and monitors the professional competence and conduct of those providing medical imaging services and offers a sense of security to Oregonians. And on behalf of the board, we ask for your support in passing HB 2245 and sincerely thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much.
I'm also asked to address other bills that affect our bill. Is this the right time? Did you want to hear a few statements?
Well, I think what we need to do is to sort of deal with your bill independently and the other bills, and then if the other bills, I mean, for example, you proposed 2 out of 12 or 3 out of 12 public members, and There are other bills that might change that number, but they're all hypothetical. So I think the thing to do would be to deal with this bill.
Okay.
We'll work this bill, and then if we need to reconcile at the end of the session, we can work that out.
We just want to make sure you're aware we know about those issues. We do have positions for you if you need
to. Tell me what issues you think are out there that will affect this.
Well, on HB 2056 and 2118, about board composition you just alluded to, we do think we are of the opinion generally that it's possible to have too many members and slow down the workings of the bill. Four might be too many public members. Two would be better. As part of that, we're also asking that our version of composition that talks about a simple majority, that we prefer to have a simple majority because some of the members proposed for our board would be physicians, four physicians and four public members, which is different than what we were used to, that it might be difficult to have a quorum other than based on a simple majority, which is what some of the other legislation is proposing.
You mean, I think we had some testimony that a quorum, that action could be by a quorum of the board. I mean, by a quorum of...
Simple majority.
By a simple majority of those present.
Would be much more manageable for the kinds of board members you're proposing to have. It'd be much easier to actually have a meeting and have a satisfied quorum requirement if it was simple majority, like our bill states. There is also, I should mention, in opposition a comment about our bill's language as it evolved, as it got through the legislative concept, that changed one section, and then that refers to Section 4, ORS 688.435. Specifically, it was Section 3, where specific licensed non-physician healthcare providers who perform medical imaging services within their defined scope of practice was substituted for what we originally proposed in our draft. This was identified as a potential loophole or space where physician assistants and nurses may be absolved of regulation under that kind of language.
Under your regulation?
Correct. As HB 2245 now reads, there are those who mentioned that this language is weakens the bill, weakens the coverage. The issue of physician assistants and nurses using within their scope of practice some imaging, and what we're talking about is venous access. They use a Doppler ultrasound to try to find a vein for doing various procedures. That's standard practice. And our feeling as the board is that they are already covered by their own boards. They're regulated entities. And if it becomes an issue, if there's an effort in some way to cross cover or do more extensive imaging just because they're not covered by our board, we feel that perhaps that could be addressed in rules. If it comes down the road 5 years from now, we find out that they're doing something to make an end run around our scope of coverage, then that could be addressed.
So you're not proposing an amendment to the bill?
We aren't, but others are. But
you are not proposing?
No, we feel we can handle this
but
administratively.
But others may come in with an amendment.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes sir.
Okay. Well, others want to join us in some order, and then we'll open this up.
I can.
Yeah, a couple more. Okay, now we can get three. You can fill the chairs. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Whitlock, and I'm the current chair of the OBRT. This board, alongside with many stakeholders, have worked hard over the past 2 years, and so I am really excited for this process and also very thankful for your time today. This bill addresses three main concepts. First, it includes licensing and regulation of the three additional imaging modalities, nuclear medicine, sonography, and MRI. Second, it will change the name of the board to reflect the licensees that it regulates, the modernized name being the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging. And third, it allows the board to align with national professional societies by changing the name of the limited permit holder to the limited x-ray machine operator. The past 2 years have been very productive for the OBRT and the coalition of stakeholders working to design this bill. We have overcome many challenges, from multiple language drafts to just plain differences of opinion, all to be able to unite proudly to present HB 2245 to you. As a native Oregonian, a radiation therapist, a radiologic technologist, and a mother of two, I am truly excited to be part of this momentous time. This bill means a lot to the profession and also to Oregon. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Thomas King. I'm coming for you today as a member of the OBRT, the Oregon Board, and I want to state my support. The last time I was here in the last session, when it was Senate Bill 144, I was the legislative rep for the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists, and it became very apparent there were some disagreements about what should be covered, not covered. And as we well know, we didn't get along with our own professional societies. And I'm happy to say that we had a lot of hard work and a lot of movement, and I think we're all on the same page now, and that we come to, with your help as well, Mr. Chair, that we have a bill that we can live with. One other thing that was not mentioned in the bill is that we're adding in a component where those students who are entering radiologic technology programs will get a student license. And I think that's a good thing, that we need to give a look over those people who are going into the field. This will give a chance to make sure that they pass their backgrounds as well in order to be in the programs, and they're going to be out there working with patients as well. So I just wanted to add that little piece in there. And one other final thought is that in my written testimony, it was a little over a week ago that CBS Evening News put a health watch out there in the field of computed tomography, CT, where the General American Medical Association stated that there was a study and there was a six-fold difference in the amount of radiation dosage that the patients were getting in CT angiography. That you could go to one place or you can go to another place and you could have as many as 600 chest x-rays, if you want to kind of picture it that way. And so that led me to believe that not everywhere you go has somebody qualified other than to have a equipment rep come in and say, push this button for this exam. It's all set. You don't need to do anything. It takes a trained, competent technologist to make adjustments for each patient, because we're not all alike here, to make sure we get the lowest achievable dose necessary to produce an exam and reduce the patient dose overall. That's about all I had to say.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Thank you. Of the technologies that this bill sort of rolls up for regulation, I'm certainly aware that x-rays, if improperly used or overly used, probably the same applies to MRIs, have a physical danger to them. Do all of the technologies and the procedures here have a physical, and I'm not talking about misdiagnosis or that, I'm talking about use of the machinery, if you will. Do all of them have a dangerous element, a physical danger element, if they're misused? I know, of course, the answer with x-ray would be yes, absolutely, but do they all fall in that camp?
Certainly x-ray has been documented in the last biological effects of ionizing radiation committee report was that there is no safe dose. So the threshold dose theory has finally been debunked. So we generally follow the practice in x-ray performance of as low as reasonably achievable. The same concept of extending do no harm and as low as reasonably achievable should be extended to all of the other imaging modalities in principle. As you may suspect, ultrasound doesn't do a whole lot of damage.
And
very
that's really
quickly.
The root of my question is ultrasound. Does ultrasound but, deserve to be lumped in with X-rays?
But there are limits. It is possible, and if you start, you have to look hard. You have to go down to electron microscopy to see what happens if you. And the manufacturers have limits on the amount of ultrasound energy that can be applied to humans, and they're regulated by their industry standards on that. The hard part of that is the machine is limited, but the amount of time spent doing the exam is not. There's no timer in the machine to make it quit when it gets to that point for saying enough that for that patient. So it is possible potentially to do harm. The problem is there will be no human studies on how much is too much because we're talking about imaging embryos and fetuses, and we're not going to have human beings volunteering to test how much can your embryo stand before something happens that comes out.
Is there any, Mr. Chair, if I may?
No, please. Keep
is there any animal evidence? I mean, I would love to be able to have, as we're deliberating, because I for one, just, I mean, lay my cards on the table. I don't think that ultrasound should be on the same table as MRIs and X-ray technology. And so
no.
I would like to see something scientific that told me I'm wrong.
One of the main studies was mice, fibroblasts, their cell surfaces become hairy looking on electron microscopy when enough ultrasound energy gets absorbed. At the frequencies that we use for medical sonography. We don't know what that means for humans. And like I said, no one's willing to risk embryos to find out what that is. So we believe and we practice with the philosophy that you should only image as long as you need to diagnose. And this is becoming more of an issue because there are places in shopping malls that are willing to image you as long as they need to make a nice video for you to take home and show grandparents. And granted, it's not they're not that interesting looking at the 8-week-old age. And most of these studies are at the third trimester type of fetuses that have something you can actually recognize. They're more interesting on video. But still, there is some medical concern and about too much time spent doing that for not medical reasons exactly.
Mr. Chair?
There is a whole literature on the effect of non-ionizing radiation.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I've had lots, I mean, and when I mean lots, I mean many ultrasounds procedure, and I've never been pregnant, but on me for various reasons. But
sure.
I appreciate the animal testing and extreme doses, but I would, and I'm, if you have it, if you don't have it, that's fine, I understand. But any sort of, I mean, in Oregon, or elsewhere in the nation, for that matter, have there been? Yeah. Of course, nobody subjects themselves to, "Hey, I have an embryo. Let's go blast it and see what happens." But are there reported cases anyway of, "Hey, listen, I think my ultrasound treatment was excessive, and here's a problem that's resulted." Is there any documentation on that end? Obviously, not by choice, but by
not
event.
Not so much. Not so much. There is ultrasound used for therapy. I'm not personally aware of any damage being done.
Okay.
By that. But the point is that we're looking at two things. We're looking at competence and performance of studies and conduct of the persons doing the studies. And a big, big part of what the OBRT is doing is relates to what happens in the examination room between a healthcare provider and a patient. And it's not about the technology. And in fact, it's not about the technology or the competence 7 times out of 10 in the board cases that we're asked to review 4 times a year. It's about conduct. And that's part of the big reason we're all here.
Is part of that diagnosis?
No.
Or misdiagnosis?
No.
Based on the technology?
No.
It's
boundary issues.
No, it's about holding a cell phone underneath the door of a changing room, taking pictures of patients while they're disrobed.
But it's not technology-driven. I hear what you're saying.
Totally.
Absolutely.
It has nothing to do with the modality.
The extent to which you believe ultrasound can be used for therapy, it means the ultrasound is having an effect on the tissues.
There's a physical effect.
It's
heating.
It would be
mechanical.
Fraudulent to use it. So
well, sure, but Mr. Chair, we need to see that. I mean, that's what I'm asking for. Is let's. Because as the good doctor said, he's unaware of any cases where there's been any problems in Oregon or elsewhere.
I just haven't searched for that recently.
Well, I understand.
I'm more aware of it.
I think we're at a place where the sonographers are not particularly unhappy with this. Is that right? I mean,
no.
We had them screaming at us last time. I think.
Not her.
Were you screaming at us last time?
She wasn't screaming.
No, sir, I wasn't.
Somebody doesn't screw.
They were there. Mr. Chair, I do have a question, though. Is this about, I mean, why do we license people? I mean, what is the purpose of licensing?
That's the question. And the purpose of licensing is that left to themselves, people are people. And in a recently widely publicized case in California, a four-count convicted rapist police officer in Los Angeles was able to practice as a X-ray technologist and sonographer, perhaps, in Martin Luther King Hospital for 10 years. Apparently, California was not conducting background checks. And in other statistics, 10% of applicants for licensure have criminal backgrounds. And I don't think it's just in Oregon. I think it's everywhere. And the effect of regulation is multifold. It gives increased status to those who can get qualified for a license. They can charge more for their services. It provides oversight in an area. It increases public confidence that when they become a patient, in at least in Oregon, if they go in and submit themselves to examinations where they're at the mercy of the people that they're in the hands of, they don't have to worry about whether or not they're a convicted felon, perhaps, or that at least somebody's looking at them before they're allowed to touch patients. I think this is an example of where government can, by due diligence and for the common good, regulate something that needs regulating, that the public benefits from directly. This is an example of the good it can do. We are, those of us on the board, are personally aware firsthand of evidence of what happens when regulation doesn't exist or isn't applied. And we've gone into detail with the board 2 years ago about this. So this is something that happens. This happens in Oregon. It happens everywhere. This is a phenomenon. So it comes down to responsibility and accountability of government for its citizens. Can you protect them? Can you, by some action, protect them from misbehavior, either by conduct or confidence?
I remember spending a wonderful evening with the conservative economist Milton Friedman, who argued that we shouldn't license physicians, that let the market do it, that they would present their credentials to the market. You'd regulate the market to make sure.
Mr. Chair, we're not talking about the practice. We're talking about the technology. And that's the, I mean, I think the points you've made, Doctor, are well stated. But
why do you regulate? Lots of reasons.
No, my question, actually, I remember because you've said that before.
Yeah, I
remember it from the
If you're licensing to protect the public, I think the argument can be made. If you're licensing to create a parochial boundary that's going to increase the wages of sonographers, then that's really not the direction we need to be going.
Yes.
Because the previous testimony was all about the high cost of health care. And so, I mean, if the argument can be made that this is about protection of the public, and I quite frankly think the argument's been made, that's not my point, but it can't be about, well, now we have prevailing wages for sonographers because you're licensed.
Well, on the wage issue, the comparison, the increased value of the person is why they might be paid more. This is as compared to having the internist say to his secretary, go in there and ultrasound that patient. He's paying secretary wages, but he's getting an ultrasound that he can then bill for. You see, that's not good health care necessarily unless the secretary is a genius and can step into the role immediately. It doesn't happen that way. But that's what we're... Some of us have been around long enough to see that situation, and I don't personally enjoy reading chest x-rays taken by someone who's untrained. And this is the background of this. There's a long history to all of this. Why we're so enthusiastic about doing this.
And if, just a comment from my recollection of the one meeting of this process that I attended, as I had and have some. I think you raise a really important point related to costs. The training requirements associated. These are not fields, in every case at least, where the entry to barrier is so great that we're looking at significant cost and sort of wage protection, if you see what I mean. At least some of these fields, the training requirements and the sort of credentialing requirements don't impose this major barrier to entry, which then inflates the cost of the provider, the wages of the provider, in a way that would lead me to a great deal of concern about this, because I asked those kinds of questions.
This will assure some barrier.
Yes, some barrier, absolutely. Yeah.
Can I ask a purely technical question?
Sure.
In Article 1, you define a licensed physician. And in Article 4, in the people who are not covered by this bill, you talk about a licensed practitioner. Is that different than a licensed physician?
I don't believe so. I'd have to defer to the lawyers on that. But I think the intent of saying licensed practitioner is code for licensed physician.
I don't think so.
They may be broad, a little broader, including
first practitioner.
And curling.
I think would be considered a licensed practitioner. I'm not sure how the law defines it, but you took care to define it in the first article and not here. And I wonder if
it's not consistent that you're saying.
You may want to check in with the legislative council and see if that's what was intended.
Where is it? Okay.
Is it right here?
Yeah, that's the first one.
Well, we have some more testimony. Let's move on to it.
You're correct. The licensed practitioner is a broader definition,
than a licensed physician.
And it may include chiropractors and nurse practitioners and PAs.
Well, and we ought to, my guess is it's defined somewhere in law.
Yes, sir.
And if so, we want to make sure you're referencing it here so we know what we're talking about. Are there some other members from the board who wish to speak? No? Well, then we'll go down the list. Is that Lorinda Andrus, is it? And Robert McDonald? And then we'll have, after that, Randy Harp and Lorraine Bevacqua.
Committee members and Chair Greenlink, thank you so much for inviting us today to speak to you on behalf of Health Bill
Please
2245. My name is Lorinda Andrist. I am currently the Director of Operations at Oregon Imaging Centers in Eugene, which is a 5-center multi-specialty imaging in Lane County, and we have close to 140 employees. I'm here representing the Society of Diagnostic Medical Sonography. I have practiced ultrasound in the state of Oregon for 22 years. I'm a past president of SDMS and a past government relations chair of SDMS as well. I would really like to commend the committee and appreciate the time that you have allowed us to further collaborate on this bill since it was first presented in May of 2007, and we're very grateful for that opportunity. I'd also really like to acknowledge Dr. Erickson's comments regarding the explanation of the bioeffects related to ultrasound and encourage the board to not lose sight of the intent of the bill, that it should be focused on what is right for the patient and having standards of care for those educational standards and licensing standards, and it should not be limited to whether the modality has bioeffects or not. As a side note, related to medical imaging for ultrasound and having fetal effects, the only study that I know of from practicing in perinatal ultrasound for 17 years is there was a study in Sweden that looked at women that had had ultrasounds, and there was an increased incidence of left-handedness. And I would
always thought that was a serious problem.
More ultrasounds, more likely they would be left-handed.
That was a study that I believe it was done in Sweden. I would have to track it down from one of the
figures. I ram this through then, Mr. Chair. That's enough for me. I'm ready to move.
I want to see that study.
Yeah. I will try to find it for you.
See, we do listen.
We'll get right up.
Back to the point of why we are here. As directed by this committee in May 2007, SDMS and other sonography organizations have worked together with the OBRT to rework the proposed language and to achieve goals regarding criminal background checks, educational standards, and appropriate credentialing for all the different modalities, and also looking at the role of students that have to play in seeing patients as well. And we're very grateful to that process, and we are in support of 2245. I do note in the testimony that was provided to you today, there was one comment regarding rural health care, and the language of the bill allows for 4-year implementation period, and with the technology of distance education, testing reviews, and CME online, there should be plenty of time for people that are practicing in a modality to achieve that certification. And again, I would encourage the committee to look at meeting the standard and intent of protecting patients, and it should not be limited to where you live in Oregon. If I have a car accident in rural Oregon and I have a CT exam of my head because there's a question if I have a bleed in my head, I would hope I would get the same standard of care whether I was in a rural area or if I was in a metropolitan area of Oregon. So
I hope so too, but I wouldn't bet on it.
But that should be our goal. I would also like to say, on behalf of ultrasound, I have worked for 17 years to see ultrasound regulated through a process. And to me, the fact that we are one of the few healthcare professions that is not regulated is astounding to me as a practitioner. And I would really be so proud to have Oregon be the first state to have that licensure. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
My name is Robert McDonald. I'm a cardiac sonographer. I've been working for 25 years. I currently work at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. And, of course, I was one of those big stick guys a couple of years ago with this committee. I'm very supportive of this bill. I think the process that the committee, along with the Oregon Board of Radiology and the Sonography Licensing Coalition that was developed, really made the process good and excellent. And from a sonographer standpoint, I think this was a good bill, and I solely support this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Nobody is grandfathered in or grandmothered in forever. Is that right? I know there was some discussion about that.
I think that is the correct language as it exists right now.
Everybody needs to get there are heads nodding in the audience.
Yeah, they have to.
They have time, but
they
need
have
to get
time. Mm-hmm. And we encourage credentialing. Yes.
Mr. Chair,
I see a letter commending you. I want to note for the record.
That's undeserved.
Helping this? No, it isn't.
My question relates to the credential required for sonographers under this bill, and that would be obtained through a credentialing organization, which is defined as a nationally recognized organization that issues credentials through testing or evaluations, et cetera, that determine competence. For sonography, what organizations would meet that?
They're actually three. There's the American Registry of Diagnostic Medical Sonography, which offers several different specialty exams. There's Cardiovascular Credentialing International, and there's also the ARRT.
And to my previous exchange with Representative Maurer, what is involved for sonography. Again, that's just one of a bunch of modalities that are in this bill, but what would be involved to obtain that credential?
I'm going to turn this over to Rob because he actually has been a volunteer with their board.
Basically, it's, again, they go have prerequisites to meet, to sit for the exam, which a lot of the them under education, schooling, and then they have to, especially if like you're a student, you have a clinical verification form that says you've done so many ultrasound studies of the modality that you're learning. So like, for example, general ultrasound, cardiac ultrasound, and so forth. And then basically once you meet the criterias of the prereqs, then you basically take an exam. And a lot of the organizations are going computer-based. At least ARDMS, American Registry Diagnostic Mammography, they go through providing their exams through PersonView, who's the largest testing organization in the world. They have thousands and thousands of sites, not only throughout the country, but also internationally. And they can sit for the exams pretty good.
And a final follow-up. And so for someone who's been in the field like you have for years, and let's assume it meets the prerequisites on education and has obviously the experience with this field, what would be the costs both in time and dollars to obtain the certification credential?
Well, again, the cost for taking the exam is anywhere from, again, at all three organizations, anywhere from $250 to, I think, $500.
Depending on how many specialty exams you choose to take.
Right. Uh-huh. Studying, that's hard to put a cost on. Again, a lot of our goals is really to get those people that are coming out of school mm-hmm. to get credentialed right away so they don't lose that loss of knowledge when they get, you know, more years of experience and stuff. And to be honest, I think that's one of the frustrations that we have, people who have been in the field 20 years and having them want to basically make them take an exam that they may or may not pass.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a quick question about the profession of sonography. Supply and demand right now in Oregon. I mean, is it easy for a sonographer to get a job in Oregon? Is it hard for it? Are wages going up? Are they stagnant? Are they down? Just to give you an idea of where we are currently.
A sonographer's, there is a salary survey, and Oregon is certainly not the highest paid, but we're certainly not the lowest paid. As far as getting a job, sonographers tend to, if you move into a city, it's usually not difficult for you to find an employer.
Even in this downturn, it's pretty easy.
Even in this downturn, like as I was saying at the beginning, I'm not representing Oregon Imaging Centers, but we have five sites. And if somebody walked through my door that was a credentialed sonographer, right, we would probably find a position for that person, even if we're not actively seeking one.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but right now the demand is ahead of the supply based on what you're telling
me. I will say, though, Oregon is very fortunate in that there is there's the Oregon Institute of Technology that has a program in the state. There's also Portland Community College. And then Oregon, to my knowledge, has at least three programs in Washington that use Oregon for their internship sites as well. So the Pacific Northwest is very fortunate to have a good supply of well-educated sonographers.
And nationwide, the demand actually goes up for sonographers.
Well, and I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. It's just, I think that testimony has been excellent in the points that are trying to be accomplished. But once again, when we're talking about reducing the cost of health care and we're establishing, I sort of thought I knew where you would go with the answers to your question, we're establishing that the demand for this technology is higher than the supply, and yet we're going to add a cost in both time and dollars, whatever that is, and we're going to exasperate that supply-demand imbalance
that already exists today?
Well, specific to Oregon, and this is based on my experience from being a previous board member with SDMS and talking with many of the educators, the Pacific Northwest has the luxury of the fact that there are several good programs here, and many of the employers require a voluntary credential right now. So it's very, well, it's not unheard of, as Dr. Erickson was implying, for somebody's secretary or medical office assistant all of a sudden, hey, you could pick up the ultrasound transducer. I would say that's certainly more the exception than the rule, and that's basically because of the expectation and standard of care within any given community here.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask, have you spoken with PCC or OIT about offering refresher kinds of courses for people preparing for the upcoming exams?
Actually, a lot of our professional societies do have registry review courses. Actually, there is, and there's companies out there that actually do offer registry review courses as well. So again, there is added costs if you want to do go through a registry review. There is. As far as the looking at our schools, especially in the Northwest, that has been asked of the schools that I'm well affiliated with, and it's just basically same way, costs, don't have time to set it up and stuff like that, and they're state run, they have to ask more money from the state to do something like that. So the fillers have been our professional societies or these registry review companies nationwide that do offer these types of classes.
And I've really noticed a change in both the societies are looking at more online webinar, so you're reducing costs. People don't have to travel to meetings. And I've actually noticed in the private companies, they're definitely taking that into account with economics. Just saw last week a new flyer that a company that has always traditionally been modeled on meetings where you go to a fancy location has a whole very impressive seminar online, easy access. It's, you know, promoting the fact that you can do it on your time, day or night. You can put it on pause and come back to it, and it looked like a very good program. And that's from my experience as being a clinical instructor with Seattle University as well.
Mm-hmm. But then if I could follow up. So if you factor in that cost as well to the cost of the exam, you're looking at about, what, $1,000?
Possibly. Sonographers are well paid if you look at the allied health professions. And like I said, a great majority already go through that process voluntarily.
And also, a lot of the hospitals actually required that you be credentialed before they even hire you.
And many will offer an incremental, small increase once you achieve that credential. Like if you're hired as a new graduate, you achieve your credential, they'll give you a small increment. Or some will even pay, although I would expect that that may not be the case anymore with the economic situation everybody's facing.
I think we need to move on.
Yeah, I agree.
One last quick question. And this came, Representative Harker forced me to ask this. Can you give me a salary range?
For sonographers or for?
It's a left-handed thing. It's okay.
I'll go with Oregon Health Science University because that's where I work for. Our salary range is I think $30 is step one to $41.
So that's an advertisement for...
It's more than you make, Ron.
A whole lot more than he makes sitting here. There's no question about that.
As I said, sonographers are fairly well paid. And if you're interested in actually looking at specific Oregon statistics, we could certainly provide that. SDMS does have a salary survey.
This is on public airwaves, and so it's an advertisement for sonographers.
Well, we need to fill the positions.
That's right.
Okay, can I call... Randy Harp and Lorraine Bevacqua. I'm sorry, was it?
No, they were kind of looking that way, didn't they? We needed to formalize this one.
excuse them.
I don't need to.
No, they figured it out.
They figured it out all in their own.
That's okay.
Let's keep seeing we move. Let's go for it.
Chair Greenlick and committee, thank you for all your work. My name is Randy Harp, and I'm a licensed radiologic technologist in Oregon for the last 30 years. And I'm the legislative person for the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists and a life member. So I've been around a couple of years when they bestow that on you. And I'm just here to support all the work that's been done. I want to thank the committee for that. I want to thank the Oregon Board of Radiologic Technology for all the work that they've done. I think we pretty much come to consensus with a few little things that can be worked on. We just want to make sure that there aren't any holes left for people to slide in. And I think that the OBRT has addressed those pretty well earlier on. I'm just here to lend my support, answer any questions you might have, and anything that you would need me to look up or find for you, I'd be willing to do that as well.
Thank you.
My name is Lorraine Bavacqua. I'm a registered radiographer. I have worked in this state for almost 25 years and have been registered for nearly 40. I am here kind of pros and cons on this particular bill, and I'm assuming that the copy that I downloaded and printed just a little over a week ago, published off the website, it has not changed. It has not changed. Okay. Earlier in the wee hours of this morning, I sent an email to you, Mr. Chair, and to the other committee members with some things that I thought were potential problems in the bill and some potential loopholes. And I would very, very much encourage you to take a look at those and consider possible amendments. We put together this bill, and I worked with Dr. Erickson a great deal to put together the legislative concept that this bill was based on. And although I realize that it has to go to legislative council and they get to put it into legalese, I think they changed a few things in here that really did change what the intent of the legislative concept was, and that's what my email was there to address. And one of them, Dr. Erickson alluded to his statement about having changed specifically who could use ultrasound that were other non-physicians. And I would be one to support changing that wording in it, in that I think this leads this whole idea wide open and basically nullifies the entire statutes, because you're saying as long as any healthcare worker, doesn't matter what their credentials are, if they're a nurse, they're a medical assistant, they're a paramedic, they could be a lab technician, as long as they could say, oh, but that's in the scope of my practice.
If it's in their legal scope
of their practice, they can use any imaging machine, not just sonography. It doesn't say that. It says any medical imaging.
Yeah.
And so they could walk in and use the X-ray machine or the therapy machine.
You're saying
machine.
If it's in, say, a physician's scope of practice,
the physician
to be able to use an X-ray machine, then you would want to amend the physician's scope of practice in this context?
No, this is not talking about physicians.
Well, a nurse practitioner's scope of practice. A
nurse practitioner's
chiropractor's scope of practice. Their legal scope of practice.
No.
We're not talking about them.
We're talking about medical assistants with 1 year of training.
Well, they don't have a scope of practice in this context.
A nurse, an RN.
An RN has a scope of practice that would either include this or not include it.
And
but
what
it's,
I'm
it's
saying
it's established
is,
by statute.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to find out what you want to do. You want to amend the scope of practice statutes to take out the ability to do things the statute now gives them?
I would like to see this statute limit very carefully what we allow these people to do in sonography, because what I fear, and I see this happening in the place where I work, they are now going to decide, they're deciding that they're going to send all of the nurses from the emergency room to a 2-day course on ultrasound so they can do all the ultrasound exams that come in through ER.
I hear what you're saying, but
and that's not acceptable.
But if it is in the nurse's current scope of practice set by statute, you would
I don't
want
know that
to,
it
by
is.
Amending this thing, redefine something in a statutory scope of practice?
No, sir. I don't think we're talking about the same thing, sir.
Well, what do you think scope of practice means? Let me ask you that. What do you think a nurse's scope of practice is when it's used in this context?
The way it's worded in this particular item, I think it is allowing them to basically get around having to be credentialed and licensed in ultrasound, and that's my concern. And maybe my colleagues in the sonography community don't see it that way, and that's
please.
Fine.
I mean, you're asking us to consider this as an amendment. I want to make sure I understand it. As it now says, if it's in their scope of practice, which means the statutorily or administratively defined scope of practice, say, by the Board of Nursing, you're saying even though it's in there, you would want to exclude their ability to do it if it has been decided by statute that they can do it. You're trying to change the scope of practice.
I don't think that they have that in their scope of practice.
Well, then it isn't an issue because the bill only allows it if it is within their scope of practice.
Then I withdraw my request if you feel that strongly.
I mean, that's Section 4.
Correct.
It says any health professional, a license, is, first of all, it says a license. And it says under their scope of practice.
Okay. If you're comfortable with it, that's all I ask you to is to take a good hard look at it.
I just want to know what you want us to do as we consider these amendments. We will consider these amendments.
Okay. The issue that you brought up about licensed physician and licensed practitioner, we did have both defined in our original legislative concept, and practitioner was removed. So that was one of the questions that was asked of one of your other people that were...
The practitioner is not removed. It's in Section 4 right now.
In the definitions?
No, in the Section 4 says a licensed practitioner is excluded from this act. But it isn't defined.
But in the definitions, practitioner, you said what's the difference between practitioner and physician? And there's only physician is the only thing that's specified in the definition section of it.
That's my problem. Yeah, that's exactly my problem.
And originally, when we submitted the legislative concept, both were in there, sir.
Well, my assumption is that it's somewhere else in statute.
Sure, it's in the underlying text, which we don't amend, but it is here on lines 18 through 20.
Oh, okay, I missed that.
It's currently in law.
It's currently in law. That's what I assumed. I assumed it was somewhere. Okay. I got it. Thank you.
Something.
So you have about license positions.
And others?
And others. You have them in memo, sir.
Well, here's where I want to go if you're done with your testimony. I would like us all to take some... I would like us all to take some time to read this thing. It's a 30-page document, and pay some attention to it. We'll establish a work session on this as soon as we can, and included in that work session, we'll look at the amendments you're proposing to see if we think that they ought to be, or anything else. My guess is there are probably some things stuck in this document somewhere that we may want to discuss besides the basic concept. So I would ask you all, okay, well that would be excellent. Our administrator says she'll have LC look at those things, so we'll have some information on them when we come back. I expect we'll take this up again in, well, we...
After the 20th.
After...
At a later point.
Yeah. Probably toward the end of the month. Okay? Thank you both very much for testifying. Thank you for paying so much attention to this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will look at the proposed amendments and at the bill. We'll have a work session, see where it goes, see what we all feel, and then perhaps move on it. We have to move on some stuff. We're going to move on something down
about 2009.
Down in Roseburg, or wherever you live, somewhere down in Medford, wherever it is we're going. And,
I'm left-handed, and I'm in
We are going to move a bill in Grants Pass. That's our plan. There'll be a work session to do it. I close the public hearing on HB 2245. Anything else to bring before us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to double check with, well, plan a couple of requests with you. How many of you folks want a carpool down to Grants Pass? And if so, the logistics of that, do you want to leave from Portland? Do you want to leave from Salem?
Well, let's find out who it is. I think if there are people, we'll...
Well, do we want to do it now, Mr. Chair? We can just do it offline.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
Can we get a state van? I'll even pitch in for the gas, but I'll drive, but I'd rather...
Yeah. We don't need to pitch in for the gas. We can get a state van, and we will get a state van. Yeah.
And that's the thing. I don't know if it will be cars or vans. Depends how many, and you guys have to be very aware of your quorum when you're traveling.
Yeah,
but we can have a quorum.
You can talk about transportation.
Hold on a minute. We can have a quorum in a car.
You just can't.
We just have to be careful what it is we do. But yeah, we will. Let Sandy know who'd like to share.
Because if we do a van, I could even drive the van, and you guys can. Unless we need two vans for all of us. Yeah. So that's what I need to do some infrastructure with.
So if you drive down, you can take mileage, and if. I only want to carpool
if we can pass a bill on the
way.
No, you can't do it.
Yes, of course you can.
Because we're getting...
You'll be paid mileage.
An inappropriate...
No.
It comes out of your stated per diem of that day, out-of-town meetings during session.
It's always got the... it's after session.
It's the interim that you get the mileage.
Ah, it's $109.
When you're in session, that's all you get, no double digits.
You know, it's not that far. I've been three times in the last 4 days. So,
what happened to the helicopter?
The Blackhawks moved out of town.
That's right, they're gone. They're not even an organ anymore. And then the next question is if in the carpooling, do folks want to go, I'm leaving the night before just because we have way too much logistics stuff to set up to try and do it at 4 o'clock in the morning and get down there. But is there anybody else that in the carpool scenario, if you want to be leaving the night before, just let me know.
I'm definitely leaving the night before.
So we have a couple of other people.
What time is the hearing start?
The auditorium. The auditorium where the hearing's going to be. We're going to have pup tests.
Where we might get a motel with a government rate. That would be useful.
What's the drive time?
Okay, guys.
So think about it, and I'll be in touch.
We're adjourned. Yeah. Can we?
Yeah. The